there. Welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald. I'm a former director of public prosecutions, a barrister practicing at Matrix Chambers and a crossbench member of the House of Lords.
And my name's Tim Owen. I'm also a barrister at Matrix Chambers, specialising in crime, public law and human rights law. In our last episode, Ken and I discussed, amongst other things, with Professor Richard Eakins, the subject of assisted dying, and the context for that discussion was judicial power, the limits of judicial power, and whether in the context of a number of decisions, the Purdy decision, the Nicholson decision, and the Diane Pretty decision, whether the courts had overstepped the legitimate bounds of judicial power. And Ken and I thought it would be good to carry on that discussion by devoting an entire episode to a discussion about the law in England and Wales on assisted dying. And our guest to guide us through this episode is the chief executive of the National Campaign and Membership Organisation Dignity in Dying, Sarah Wootton. Sarah has been the chief executive since 2008. Before that, she led campaigns on reproductive choice at the Family Planning Association and gender equality at the Equal Opportunities Commission. On becoming CEO of Dignity in Dying, Sarah established a new charity called Compassion in Dying, which supports people to plan ahead and control their end of life within the current legal framework. And in 2020, Sarah co-authored a book titled Last Rights, that's R-I-G-H-T-S, Last Rights, The Case for Assisted Dying, which argues that our laws and culture governing death and dying need radical reform. And having read the book, I would strongly recommend it to everyone interested in this subject. It's got the most extraordinary list of tributes from prominent individuals in different areas of public life. So with that introduction, Sarah, welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you, Tim and Ken, and I'm glad to be here.
Great.
Good to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sarah, we usually begin briefly with getting a sense of our guest's background. I think you did a degree in, was it neurobiology or neuroscience?
Neurobiology at Sussex University, yes.
Yeah. And so what took you from that degree into Dignity in Dying, which, as I say, you became the CEO in 2008? What was it you did between leaving university and joining Dignity in Dying?
Well, I was a scientist, so I suppose that I looked at issues from a logical point of view, but I also like looking at the bigger picture, how things worked, why things happened in that way. And even though I was a scientist in the science part of Sussex, I was fascinated by the arts side of things too, and how all that worked, and history and social policy, and how things came to be. I took a couple of wrong turns in my career, so I think I'm probably defined by what I don't like as well as what I do like. So right. My first job after leaving university, I became a marketing executive for SmithKline Beecham on the Lucozade brand. And though I was a very good salesperson, I hated it. I felt like a cog in a wheel. And I didn't know what was going on. And then I went and moved. This is in the 90s. And then I went to a sales promotion agency where I had exactly the same experience. So it didn't work for me, really, the commercial sector at all. And I was sacked twice. I think it's very useful to have been sacked. I think it shows you what you can't do and makes you move away from things that don't suit you, basically. Yeah. So I went to the voluntary sector, community service volunteers, but my breakthrough job was definitely the Family Planning Association when I was in my late 20s. And and the pro-choice cause of reproductive health, abortion and sex education was what really made my heart sing.
Yeah. And so, and as I say, you joined Dignity in Dying in 2008. Was it already a running organisation at that point? Or were you joining it as a founder, so to speak?
No. So Dignity in Dying was formed in 1935 and as the Voluntary Euthanasia Society. My predecessor had rebranded it in 2006 to Dignity in Dying and changed its aims as well. So it was around assisted dying, so not voluntary euthanasia, where it's where the patient takes the final act, and it's around people with terminal illness and mental competence.
Right.
So that was a real change. So yeah, so I arrived in 2008. It was a pretty small organisation. They just lost the Joffe bill and the Diane Pretty case as well. But I mean, amazing work was done by the organisation. So they'd absolutely laid the groundwork for for the campaign that came after. But yes, I've been here 15 years.
I mean, it has had a very long history, hasn't it, this organisation, under a number of different names. And as you say, it was formed in 1935, when eugenics and all that kind of stuff was fairly controversial and quite a politically charged topic. Some quite surprising people supported notions of eugenics in the early 20th century. But it was also, obviously highly controversial. I mean, the first bill, I think, was in 1936, and it was strongly opposed by the BMA. And in 1950, a bill was brought before the House of Lords and was so widely condemned, it had to be withdrawn without a division. So it was a kind of long struggle, wasn't it, to get this organisation, if you like, respectable?
Yes, I think that's right. And I think you're absolutely right about other sort of powerful causes having similar kinds of leaders. Mary Stopes would be another example in reproductive healthcare, for example. And I think it was actually, the organisation was started by clerics and doctors and lawyers. So they were looking at the kind of the morality and the real issues around life and you know, how you live it and how you end your life, because dying is part of living. But it has been a long history that we've built on. But at its heart now, it's really around listening to patients and how patients want to die. This is about taking an issue that has been the purview of the state or the church and turning it into something that where an individual decides how they die. So from that perspective, I think that Dignity in Dying is like many other progressive social campaigns, like reproductive rights or LGBT rights or even racial justice, which are all campaigns that have eventually won after decades of chipping away at a deeply unfair and outdated status quo.
I mean, I think there's clearly been a development in public opinion, and all the recent polls show very high levels of support for an assisted dying bill. And it's been a real turnaround. I mean, if you go back to the 60s when the organisation was called Exit, it was quite controversial. The chief executive, a man called Nicholas Reed, was sent to prison for eventually 18 months on appeal for... he was working with a guy called Mark Lyons, who were helping people to kill themselves, people who wanted to die. And the organisation had a booklet called Guide to Self-Deliverance. And this was all pretty controversial and a little bit sinister. And it seems to me that there's been an extraordinary change since the late 60s, early 70s, early 80s, and a huge groundswell of public opinion, as I say. And now Dignity in Dying is a highly respected organisation and hugely influential. So what was the main impetus behind that turnaround?
That's good of you to say so, and I'm not sure it's true. I mean, there are still people in the right to die sort of space, like Philip Nietzsche, who are, you know, they run seminars on self-deliverance, as it's called, or sort of self-promoters around new models of how you would take your own life. I think to answer your question, Ken, it's really around being clear that we're here for dying people. So that the purpose of Dignity in Dying is to shorten death, not shorten life. And also, secondly, to be really clear that we are not the ones who are going to help people do that. We are a lobbying organisation. So we are trying to change the law. We are not trying to help people outside the edges of the law. The charity I set up that Tim mentioned at the beginning, Compassion in Dying, works completely within the law. So if, you know, you can get advice on how to control your death, make plans, discuss it, decide the treatment you do and don't want. But that is purely inside the law. So we don't go outside the boundaries of that. And I think those two things have helped.
I want to ask you, obviously, now to just outline what your reform proposals are. But let me just set the scene for people who aren't familiar with it on what the current law is. So the Suicide Act of 1961 That is the main relevant legislation. Suicide or attempted suicide are not in themselves criminal offences, but under Section 2(1) of the Suicide Act 1961, it is an offence for a person to do an act capable of encouraging or assisting the suicide or attempted suicide of another with the intention of encouraging or assisting suicide or attempted suicide. And the maximum available sentence is 14 years. So it's an unusual offence in that you can be guilty of conduct capable of encouraging or assisting an act by the person which is not itself unlawful.
And just to pause there for a second, Tim, it's also clear from the sentence of 14 years that it was regarded by Parliament, and presumably still is, as an extremely serious offence. As we observed with Richard Eakins last week, there's only one sentence up from 14 years, which is life. So it's regarded as a serious offence.
And just to complete the summary of the law, proceedings for an offence under Section 2(1) of the Suicide can only be brought by or with the consent of the Director of Public Prosecutions, and that was relevant to some of the case law that we'll come on to. But the reality is prosecutions under Section 2(1) are relatively rare. In April 2022, the CPS, Crown Prosecution Service, said between April 2009 and March 2022, 174 cases recorded as assisted suicide were referred to it by the police. It did not proceed with 115 cases, and the police withdrew 33. And on cases that led to action, the CPS said there are currently 8 ongoing cases. 4 cases of encouraging or assisting suicide have been successfully prosecuted. 1 case of assisted suicide was charged and acquitted after trial. And 8 cases were referred onwards for prosecution for homicide or other serious crime. So that's the Suicide Act. And of course, so-called euthanasia, actually directly causing somebody's death. For example, a doctor who deliberately gives excessive quantities of drugs that aren't medically necessary can be liable for murder. So it's a bit lengthy, that summary, but that's the law as it is now. What's your reform policy at Dignity in Dying?
Well, I mean, I think first off, you're right about the stats. And I want to point out that even though the CPS has had around, 182 cases referred to it, Dignitas, as I know well, has assisted over 400 British citizens to die. So you can see the gap between those two figures. So
just to be clear, Dignitas, that is the organisation in Switzerland.
That is the Swiss Assistance to Die organisation where Britons and other nationalities can go to have an assisted death if they fit their criteria. So you can see that assuming that most of the people who've been to Switzerland may well have been accompanied by a loved one, you know, how can it be said that the current law is offering protection when half of those cases never even come to the attention of the Crown Prosecution Service? What I would say is that the current law is not regulated, it's not safe, and it's not fair. Because at the moment, what dying citizens, Britons face, if they're looking at a protracted death, is suicide, Switzerland, or suffering. So in terms of what Dignity in Dying is trying to change, we're looking for a narrow, very, very narrow change in the law, so that in that section 2 that you talked about earlier, so that people with terminal illness and mental competence have the right to seek a medically assisted death in this country. And if I can broaden out for a moment, I mean, there are two sorts of assisted dying laws in the world. There are those narrow laws that are present in the US, in Australia, and in New Zealand. That's the kind of law that Dignity in Dying go for. And then the laws that other people know about probably more broadly, the Netherlands, the Belgium laws, the Canadian laws. So this isn't a hypothetical discussion. This is coming to Britain. So there's a bill in Scotland, there's a bill in Jersey, there's a bill coming to the to the Isle of Man. The President Macron has said that he will legalise by the end of this year. The Republic of Ireland has just pulled together a parliamentary committee to look at this. 200 million people have access to these laws now throughout the world. So it really is much more than a sort of philosophical discussion for people.
To be clear, the model that you're going for is sometimes known as the Oregon model, which is a very restrictive model.
Yes.
Oregon allows assisted dying. It doesn't allow euthanasia. It allows assisted dying, and under very strict conditions, there has to be medical intervention, medical approval, cooling off periods, and so on. Other jurisdictions like the Netherlands and Belgium, I think allow more direct forms of euthanasia. And in the case of Belgium, I think they allow it even for people under the age of 18, unless I'm mistaken.
They do.
So some countries have a much more liberal regime. One of the arguments against assisted suicide is always that it's a slippery slope. But I think in Oregon, which has had these laws for the longest time, there's been no slippery slope at all.
No, the slippery slope is completely wrong. It's a fork in the road. You choose the law you can get. And it's really important to be clear that these broader laws are safe. They're working as intended. They're based on unbearable suffering. They might be unpalatable to us, but that doesn't mean that they are unsafe. And all of them bring protection and peace of mind. And even with these broader laws, only under 5% of deaths are assisted in those countries. Under 1% of deaths are assisted in Oregon and the other US states. So this is an option that not many people choose, but knowing it's there brings huge peace of mind. So a third of people in the US who have the prescription don't use it. There's a reason for that.
Sorry, can you just tell us, Sarah, what the safeguards are in the proposal that you're making? So what would be the safeguards in terms of the state of mind of the person whose death is going to be assisted, and who would have to supervise or give an independent view on it?
So two independent doctors would have to certify that somebody is terminally ill and has 6 months to live and is of a clear and settled intention, and they're not being coerced. But we've also added an additional safeguard. So the British law would be the most safeguard in the world of a high court judge, a family court judge, approving that those conditions are in place. There'd be various kind of cooling off periods, and there'd be a psychiatrist would have to be involved if someone's mental competence was in doubt, though it wouldn't automatically be involved. So it would be a very, very safeguarded, limited law. But the critical thing is the transparency and scrutiny over that. So these conversations, which at the moment are taking place behind closed doors, a Briton is going to Switzerland every week to have an assisted death, then and people are taking the law into their own hands in this country. So we know that dying people are twice as likely to take their own life by suicide. 650 people every year are taking their own life through suicide, dying people, because they're trying to control what to them would be an unbearable death. So this issue about safety, patient safety, is completely sort of balanced on assisted dying. That would be absolutely, it's a much, much safer law. If you ban assisted dying, you don't get rid of assisted dying, you make it unsafe.
I think this is a point that's very, very well worth making, actually. I mean, one of the problems with the situation we have at the moment is it's a bit like the Wild West. There's no state intervention at all. People are taking it upon themselves with friends and relatives to go abroad, usually to Switzerland. Everyone's staring criminal liability in the face, and there's no control or regulation around it. I think it's quite alarming that the CPS's answer in 2021, the answer in Parliament, showed that 8 cases of assisted suicide that had come to the attention of the CPS, goodness knows about those that hadn't, were referred onwards for prosecution for homicide or other serious crime. And this would suggest that there's some pretty dubious practice around assisted dying out there, not in Dignitas, I'm sure, which is a completely reputable organisation, but it does look like a state of affairs which is crying out for regulation beyond the simple criminal law. And I suppose you would argue that what you're proposing would provide those safeguards and that form of regulation.
Absolutely, yeah. No, and that's very clear from countries where it has been regulated. So no country has ever repealed the law. And what you saw with the Eccleston case in 2019, which was referred, I mean, so Mavis Eccleston was prosecuted for murder and manslaughter by the CPS in 2019. And she went through the entire criminal justice system and was only found not guilty by a jury in the end. As a result of that case, she'd helped her terminally ill husband, Dennis, to take an overdose of the painkillers that he'd been hoarding for that very purpose. And you know, she was arrested in her nightgown and taken to the police station, and then taken, as I said, she was prosecuted, an 80-year-old grandmother in that way. So I would say that the CPS has been forced to fill the void of Parliament's inaction. They're trying to patch up laws. So the CPS, the current DPP, announced a 12-week consultation last year, trying to get updates for its prosecution guidance for homicides that are similar to the guidance that Ken and Keir Starmer were involved in for assisted suicide. So it's specifically with regard to mercy killings and suicide pacts. And I think that the critical thing here is that they're recognising... What he's doing is recognising that suicide pacts and mercy killings are different from murder and manslaughter, and they should be treated differently by our criminal justice system. And I think that differentiating those acts of compassion from murder is an important milestone on the road to legalisation. But it's a clear indication that the blanket ban on assisted dying doesn't work. But it's only law change that can deal with that, and only Parliament can deliver that.
Sarah, I'm interested in, obviously, your recommendation, your reform proposal to involve a High Court judge in the ultimate decision. So a judge would have to approve the, in a sense, the application to be allowed to assist someone to die. And I was going to ask you in a second if you've consulted with the judges in the family division about...
Charlie Faulkner did.
And the reason I ask that is this. Soon after I became a Silk in 2000, I was instructed in the case that became known as In Re A, Conjoined Twins. And that was a very sort of landmark case involving these two Maltese twins who had been born conjoined to Maltese Catholic parents. And the situation was that only one of the twins, Jodie, had a heart, and Mary was parasitic, if you like, for her life on Jodie. And unless separation surgery was going to be performed, they would both die. And so the case came before the family division and eventually the Court of Appeal, which is when I became involved, acting for Jodie, the twin who could survive, but only if the operation took place. And the doctors obviously wanted to perform life-saving surgery, but needed ultimately the consent of the High Court, because the official solicitor acting for Mary wanted the case litigated. So anyway, that was the context. And it was an extraordinary few days in court, with the three judges really, I thought, impressively debating the moral and ethical issues at play there, where if you did nothing, they'd both die, but you would perform an operation knowing you would kill one of the children, Mary. So that was a case in which I never felt that the judges thought it was inappropriate that they were being involved in such a difficult decision. And so, I mean, my instinct would be, but I'd be interested to hear what you say about what the family division judges have said as to whether they would be resistant to being involved in this kind of process.
I think when Charlie brought his bill forward in 2014, 2015, this was raised as an issue, because some people in the Lords were saying, you know, the judges won't want to do this. And I think he took some soundings. And I think there may have been some reluctance amongst some family court judges to take this on. Is that right, Sarah? Have I misremembered?
Well, I think he spoke to the sort of the then... you know, the president, yes. And I think he said that that would be exactly the sorts of issue that they could try. Okay. And I think the issue was more about workload than about the principle of the issue, is my understanding. But I think that, I mean, what I'd say about this is that, you know, we have the opportunity here to make a British law, so we don't have to take something off the shelf. We can look at all the different sort of approaches from other countries and see what works for us. What we need is a tightly regulated and safeguarded law that gives people choice, that isn't so tightly regulated that people can't access it, which might be the views of opponents, but it does give people some surety that there's a way forward in terms of people having protection and against coercion. And those are the sorts of issues that judges... Though also, actually, those are the sorts of issues that doctors too do have to deal with. And you've got to remember that under the current law, people can refuse treatment that results in their own death. And they can starve, for example, the options, the sort of ethical options now that are perfectly lawful would include people starving and dehydrating themselves to death. Noel Conway, who lost the appeal in the end, he wanted to pick up the baton where Tony Nicholson had left off. So Noel needed to have oxygen for nearly 24 hours a day by the end because of his motor neurone disease. So after he'd lost the case and he did want to bring his sort of suffering to an end, he was quite far along. He was nearly completely paralysed. He asked his doctors, his palliative care support, to sedate him and then remove his oxygen so that he could suffocate to death. So, I mean, I think that you've got to compare that with what we're talking about, which is where you would take a dose of barbiturates that would end your life in 15 minutes, giving you the option. His family had to watch him suffocate to death over a matter of hours. And I think that is really completely it's just unsupportable that we should be looking at that as an option, really.
I mean, your book looks at a number of very, very distressing examples. I mean, in a perfectly dignified way, but hugely distressing examples, which I don't really want to repeat here, but people can imagine them for themselves. But the parliamentary history of this has been, I was going to say checkered, but it's not checkered. It's wholly disastrous from your point of view so far. I mean, as I said before...
I wouldn't say that, Ken. I wouldn't say... Well, 2015 wasn't brilliant, but yeah.
Well, let's just look at the actual records. I mean, in as I've said already, in 1950, a bill brought before the House of Lords was so widely condemned by their lordships and their ladyships that it had to be withdrawn without... division. In 1967, a bill was brought into the Lords because not a single MP was willing to do so. And that's rather surprising, given the period that we're talking about, 1967, when the Abortion Act and various other bills, acts were coming in. In 2014-15, Charlie Faulkner's bill ran out of time. There was a long debate, long, long debate in the Lords. And rather more depressingly, in 2015, Rob Maris MP, the Labour MP, did get his get a vote on his bill in the Commons, but it was defeated by 330 to 118. And the most recent debate in the Lords was Baroness Meacher's bill in 2019. I think the reality in the Lords...
It was October 2021.
Oh, you're right,
yeah.
So, sure, yeah. I think the reality in the Lords is that a majority of the House of Lords would probably support this bill. But I'm not sure that's even now the case in the House of Commons. What do you think about that?
Well, I do know where most people stand because we monitor where people stand, and we have a whole network of constituents working for us with MPs, and we have got a majority in the House of Lords, and we've actually got a slight majority in the House of Commons at the moment for law change. I think the interplay between sort of legal and parliamentary strategies has always been something we've done. And as I said at the beginning, this is about chipping away at a status quo. It's really around gradually moving the context and letting people see the evidence for themselves and changing their minds about that. There have been people who've looked at this and considered what it means to them. So we I think there's been a bit of a game of chicken between the courts and the and Parliament, certainly in Westminster, and that's what we've done. So when Charlie lost in 2009 with his amendment to the Coroners and Justice Bill, that's when Debbie's judicial review won,
That's Debbie Purdy. Debbie Purdy, yeah.
Yes, and obviously you were involved in that, Ken, to an extent. And then there was a majority for change for Charlie's bill. And your point around time, parliamentary time for these bills in Westminster is really, really essential. So Molly's bill got through. I mean, Robert Winston withdrew his amendment to it, and it did have a majority support, but it wasn't offered any time to progress through its parliamentary stages. And without parliamentary time, in the same way that the then Home Secretary made sure that David Steele had with abortion in 1967, a bill will not get through the Commons. But it will get through Scotland, where we have a majority for change, because time is built into their system. And it would get through Jersey, where they've got a government bill that is going to be voted on in February next year. And it would get through the Isle of Man, where a private member's bill is going to come for its second reading in autumn. So these pieces of legislation are coming towards us, and you know they're like other conscience issues. It's around, you know, I mean, Lady Hale said that Noel's case was a matter of transcendent public importance, but you know it's that wariness between stepping on the toes of Parliament. And I think that's where we are now, is looking at a parliamentarian strategy where we do have majorities for change.
I mean, I think your analysis is absolutely spot on. First of all, people changing their minds. I mean, I confess I've changed my mind about this, and I now support this bill, support it strongly, and have now for some time. And I can explain that later if you want to know why. But I also agree that the courts and Parliament are in a game of chicken. I think that's rather unedifying, and I think the Purdy case was part of that. I know Tim's got an interest in the Purdy case and my role in this and what I felt about that case as it was progressing. I mean, I think that the fact of the matter is that the courts, it seems to me, are unhappy with the parliamentary position. Many judges feel, as Lady Hale stated, that this is a matter of transcendent public importance. And I think that strong feeling on their part is causing them at times to usurp what should really be a parliamentary decision here. And I think Parliament needs to develop the guts to make it. And I'm talking specifically about the House of Commons.
Let me just, let's just summarise for people who don't know about the Purdy case.
Yeah.
And it did involve Keir, although by the time the case reached the House of Lords, Keir Starmer had taken over from Keir. But the decision arose, taken by you, Ken, the decision that was under judicial review was in January 2008, and it was effectively saying that in circumstances where a prosecution under the Suicide Act required the consent of the DPP, then the requirements of legality and the requirements of Article 8 of the European Convention of Human Rights, the right to private life and family life, meant that the law had to be accessible and foreseeable, and to the extent that the DPP was therefore exercising this discretion whether or not to charge somebody with assisting another person's suicide, there needed to be clear, foreseeable guidelines set out in a code which everyone could understand. And in the end, she succeeded, and the ruling in the House of Lords was indeed that there had to be such guidance, and it was duly issued, I think, in 2010, and it remains, so to speak, the policy of the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service. So, Ken, I mean, you took the decision. Obviously, there will have been discussions, and maybe there's certain things you can't talk about. But what was the thinking behind your decision?
I think I can certainly talk about it. I mean, the reality was that we weren't prosecuting these cases, as I explained in our discussion with Richard Eakins. And just so that people listening know, if some people may not know, that there's a two-stage test for a prosecution under our system. First of all, there has to be sufficient evidence, which simply means a conviction is more likely than not on that evidence. And secondly, if that test is passed, the prosecution should be in the public interest. Now, in a lot of these cases, bodies were cremated in Switzerland, so we had no real evidence about the cause of death. In others, either the body was returned and the post-mortem showed massive barbiturate poisoning, or the people who had assisted the suicide weren't hiding it. And in those cases, we did have enough evidence. However, we invariably decided in scores of cases that there was no public interest in prosecuting them. So what Debbie Purdy was asking for was that we publish guidance so that people who assisted their loved ones in this process would have a better idea of whether they were going to be prosecuted or not. We didn't think it was part of prosecution guidance or the DPP's function to tell people how they might get away with committing a serious criminal offence, which is essentially what we thought we'd be doing if we provided this guidance. I mean, my stance as a DPP, the Director of Public Prosecutions, was to say to the public, do not assist other people to commit suicide. It's against the law. And the maximum sentence is 14 years. Publishing guidance, we thought, would simply be a rather odd way of enabling people to get around that law. And so we opposed it. But as you said, I mean, the Divisional Court and the Court of Appeal unanimously were with us, and the House of Lords, the Supreme Court, a very liberal constitution of the Supreme Court, I have to say, Tim, was against us. But I have to say, Keir agreed with our stance when he took over, and I think was a little surprised, as I was, by the result in the Supreme Court. But there you are.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a comment on that as well. I mean, I think... because I think it is important what Keir did and what the guidelines do, because for me... They basically clarify that compassionate assistance to die won't be prosecuted, but malicious encouragement will be.
Yeah, yeah.
But if compassionate assistance won't be prosecuted, then it should be decriminalised. And going back to your point around the sort of the difference between the judges and the court and the parliament, I want to bring in Lord Sumption's stance on this.
Yes.
Because in his Reith lectures in 2019, he said, I think that the law should continue to criminalise assistance in suicide, and I think that that law should be broken. I think that it should be broken from time to time. I find that extraordinary. So, you know, for people who don't have the resources to access medical help or to get safe assisted dying or get legal advice to protect themselves and their families, it's hugely inhumane advice offered from a position of great privilege by assumption. So he's basically, how can a judge say that a law should be broken?
Oh, well.
This is the dilemma. This is precisely the dilemma. I mean, what we were really doing in not prosecuting these cases was decriminalising a certain category of offence. In other words, if the intervention was compassionate, if the individual had a settled will, and this was our policy as well as Keir's, then no prosecution would take place. So in a sense, prosecutors were decriminalising a law because the parliament didn't have the guts to do it.
Juries wouldn't convict either. They wouldn't convict Mavis Eccleston.
They probably wouldn't have done, but that's not the way the evidential test works. The evidential test works on the basis of positing a reasonable jury who follow the law. But I think this was exactly the problem that we were in a sense decriminalising the law. I mean, the reason I supported the system as it was for so long was that I agreed with Sumption that the law should remain in place in order to protect vulnerable people from inappropriate interventions, encouraging them to take their own lives. And I thought the existence of the law did that. And when you coupled it with the prosecutorial discretion, which was being used not to prosecute those who were vulnerable, not to prosecute those who were acting compassionately, you had a kind of win-win. I've changed my mind about that because I think, apart from anything else, it doesn't protect those who don't have the capacity or ability to get to dignitas. It doesn't protect those who don't have the means to get to dignitas. It doesn't really protect people from all the horrors of a police investigation and the possibility of being imprisoned for doing what any compassionate person would do. And I just felt the more I've read about this, the more I've thought about it, that given the sorts of safeguards which your proposals include, that this is now the right thing for us to do.
Mm. Of course, when Lord Sumption said that in the Reith lecture, when he was no longer a judge, when he was a judge on the Supreme Court, he gave judgment in the Nicholson case, which is the last big case to be before the Supreme Court. And his position then, and it's actually one I agree with, is that this issue is not a matter for the courts to rule upon. It is par excellence a legislative matter, and it requires Parliament to confront this issue and to resolve it and to legislate, as it's not an area into which the judges should tread. And I suppose my question to you is, I mean, do you accept the legal battle is run now? There was a successful outcome in Purdy to the extent, as we've discussed, it required the issuing of a prosecutorial policy. But as for the law on assisted dying and changing it, the courts have done their job now. They're not going to change, are they?
I think that's right. I think it is down to the parliaments now. That issue needs to be forced in each parliament. And you can also see, I suppose, from Roe versus Wade in the US, that once you actually have a parliamentary decision, a legislative decision, then that's a safer decision than something that's made in a court that can be overruled. I was smiling because you talked about Sumption changing his mind from when he was a judge to when he stepped down, and I find that a lot. So Matt Hancock is a supporter of law reform now, but wasn't when he was health secretary. I'm looking forward to Dominic Raab saying that he supports assisted dying and a change in the law. So
I mean, it's true that people when they're secretaries of state or whatever have different responsibilities and sometimes can't always act on their conscience. But I think there's a general sense in which there is a great sort of national change of mind developing about this. And the support is becoming such that really I think the pressure on MPs is going to become unbearable for them. And I think that's the way this is going to change. I agree with you, Tim, about the courts. I think the courts have done as much as they're going to. They're not going to legalise assisted dying, and they're not constitutionally able to do so. They've made their views, at least the more recent Supreme Court constitutions have made their views clear on this issue, but they're not going to change the law in a sufficiently dramatic way that assisted suicide, assisted dying becomes legal. It's really for Parliament to get a grip on this at long last.
I think the other key views that we should cover are doctors, the views of doctors, and they have changed considerably too. So the BMA surveyed its membership in 2020, and it's had around 30,000 responses, so it's the biggest sort of survey of medical opinion on assisted dying in this country. And it found that 50% of BMA members are actually personally in favour of assisted dying. And they went neutral. I mean, it is true that doctors have very different deaths to their patients. So they choose how they want to die quite carefully. They don't become over-treated. They know the likely prognosis of a disease. They weigh up quality and quantity of life. Yeah. And some of them have their own. I know one who keeps his his assisted dying preparation in his fridge.
Yeah, I think one thing it's worth addressing before we finish, Tim, is this question of palliative care. Because in the House of Lords, some of the most powerful speeches against Charlie Faulkner's bill, I wasn't able to be there for the Meacher bill, for the Charlie Faulkner bill, came from specialists in palliative care. And they seem to present it as a sort of either or. You have assisted dying or you have palliative care. But one of the reasons I've changed my mind is that looking at what's happened in Oregon, for example, the quality of palliative care and the amount of resource put into palliative care has actually increased during the currency of this legislation. I think the reason is that once this becomes a public issue and once public pressure forces a change in the law to permit assisted dying, people are focusing on those last few weeks and months of people's lives, of their own lives, and it becomes more of a public issue, and this attracts funding and it attracts specialisation and expertise. There's no doubt at all that palliative care in Oregon and in other countries that have the Oregon model is now better than it was before the changes in the law. And I think that's something that you remark upon quite often, Sarah.
Yes, definitely. So the New South Wales legislation, for example, got a $400 million or dollar boost to palliative care services. And that's true wherever assisted dying is legalised. It's not just about the funding for palliative care. It's also around the conversation as well, because, you know, it boosts an open and honest conversation about how you want to die when dying is a reality for you. I think your point as well, Ken, about this isn't an either or is absolutely critical. It's not a substitute for palliative care assisted dying. Even the most implacable palliative care physician would say that most people have good deaths. Palliative care, some people are beyond the reach of even the best palliative care. And so what people want is great palliative care, but also the choice of assisted dying. So I think, you know, that's really, really critical.
Well, Sarah, it's been a really interesting discussion on a very difficult and important topic. Let me finish this discussion by just quoting something from the foreword written by Lord Finkelstein, Daniel Finkelstein, to your excellent book, Last Rites. He was writing this in 2020 when the Prime Minister was Boris Johnson. And he says this at the end of his foreword, saying, "Let me address myself finally to the government. I do understand the conservative way of looking at things. Resistance to unnecessary change, fondness for the settled way, respect for generations of habit and practice. But the great strength of conservatives is the ability to understand the moment when the need for change has come. This has allowed Tory governments to implement audacious reforms and accommodate small ones. This reform," by which he meant reform to the law on suicide-assisted dying, "is the settled will of the people. It is supported by more than 80% of voters. It has enjoyed this sort of overwhelming backing for decades. It extends to all citizens the security and certainty of the law and a choice over the way they deal with their death. What could be more conservative than that?" So he posed that question of, it was a challenge in a sense to Boris Johnson to get on with the reform. Well, obviously, Mr. Johnson is no longer with us as Prime Minister, and there doesn't seem to be any sign of the current leadership of the Conservative government taking it on. But there is a Health and Social Care Select Committee inquiry about to take evidence.
Yep, something we called for a long time. Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that's all the result of your work. And so certainly I personally fully support what you're campaigning for and wish you all the best.
Thank you. It's interesting, though, that in fact the Tory government did respond positively in quite a subtle way that you might not be aware of. I tabled a government petition last year, which got over 150,000 signatures, and we had the debate on the 4th of July. And the then Justice Minister, James Cartledge, appeared to commit the government to ensuring that any bill would have enough parliamentary time to get through all its stages as long as it commanded a majority in the Commons. And that's something that is still being repeated by Tory MPs. So,
That's an absolutely critical concession from the government if they hold to that. And I certainly hope that if there was a change of government at the next election, the new government would provide parliamentary time for this, because this is one of the last great reforms, I think, and it's so overdue. And I must say I call on parliamentarians to get on with this, to grip this issue, to read about it, to think about it, read your book, Last Rites. It's beyond time now, it really is. And as I say, I've comprehensively changed my mind, and I do think that if others really get to grips with this issue, they will too. So thank you for joining us, Sarah, and I do applaud you and the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much, both of you. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Tim Owen and me, Ken McDonald. If you enjoyed this conversation, do subscribe, share the podcast with your friends, and check out our back catalogue, which includes conversations with Brenda Hale, who we mentioned today, Dominic Grieve, Dinah Rose, who was counsel in the Purdy case, and many others. Thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you again very soon.